The opinions and views expressed in this program are not necessarily those of KUCI, the UC Board of Regents, or anyone.
This is KUCI 88.9 FM, Irvine, California. I'm Nathan Callahan, and this is Weekly Signals. That's right, Mahler. Mm-hmm. What shall we talk about today, boy? Mortality? Good grief. But I know just the person. Claudia Shambaugh, the host of Ask a Leader, right here on KUCI, every Tuesday at 9 in the morning. Well, you need to get up earlier. You know, I was reading a story from BBC News. AI photos show people with secondary breast cancer their lost future. Basically, the story is a PR piece for a well-admired professional photographer who has a show at London's Saatchi Gallery exhibiting AI-generated images of terminal cancer patients experiencing future events in their lives well beyond the date of their predicted encounter with death. Now, according to the article, 10 people living with secondary breast cancer have been given a glimpse into a future they know they may not live to see. And all this was created by Edelstein. Edelstein was born and grew up in South Africa. She graduated as a social worker before starting work as a press photographer in Johannesburg in 1981. Then she moved to London in 1985. And since then, her portraits have appeared in the Sunday Times Magazine, the New York Times Magazine, Vanity Fair, Time, and The New Yorker. Now, as far as this exhibit goes, it all seems kind of ghoulish to me. What do you think, Claudia?
Well, it gets at this larger American cultural construct that death may not be inevitable. So I'm concerned about any of these kinds of enterprises that are interfering with the coming to terms with grief. That's another way of saying it's ghoulish to me, too.
Yeah, well, I'm looking at it one side, just, I guess, superficially. And that when I see this, it seems like we're dealing with a death by making it living. And so it's almost like a zombie character that we're looking at.
It is a zombie.
And where you're coming from is that this is our denial in our culture of death and trying to find ways to live forever.
Well, you know, I read a long time ago when Isabel Allende, the historic fiction writer, in an interview about her book, as an aside, she said, Americans do not understand the inevitability of death. And so she attributed that to our cultural sort of construct, and it keeps getting borne out when these kinds of topics come up. And now with AI, that's like an open-ended.
I don't call it a frightening development, but it's a disappointing development. It's a bit of progress that I think is going to not make us progress, but rather go backward. One of the subjects for this Gallery of Hope, as the exhibit is called, Louise Hudson, now 58, was first diagnosed with breast cancer in July of 2022, which then spread to her liver. She now has a life expectancy of about 6 months. Louise's image at the exhibition shows her celebrating her 60th birthday by performing with her amateur dance company while her husband of 30 years, Barry, looks on with pride. The photo, she said, the photo was just amazing. It was just beautiful. Seeing it was overwhelming, but overwhelming in a good way. I may have cancer, but I'm having the time of my life. I know I'm not going to be around for a long time, so I'm going to have a bloody good time, and I'm going to be dragged kicking and screaming. To death, I think she means.
So in that instance, and we may be talking about other enterprises related to this AI extension of one's persona, but in this case, it looks like she's giving consent to her projection after her death.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
But it is not present in other forms of AI generations of people. There are other enterprises that you maybe bring up where it's all about the survivors. They're building up the grief bot, and that the dear departed had no consent given.
That's true. If you had an opportunity to do this, would you consider it at all?
No.
That's pretty final. The photo, to me, as far as the different types of bringing back the dead go, seems gimmicky.
It's what we mean by shiny. It's super shiny.
It seems so superficial. And it reminds me of why the Eastern Orthodox Church doesn't like images inside. Biblically, it would be a sin. It's almost a graven image. The article goes on to say that some may assume seeing yourself in a future you have been told you are unlikely to make would be unbearably sad. Mm. But this last person we were talking about, Louise, said she found it mostly inspiring. Now, there are all sorts of different people out there, but to me, it seems unbearably sad that she would think it's mostly inspiring. I think it would be much more productive for the people who have this terminal illness if they documented what was really happening in their lives and how people were coming together with them and how they could share things in the present with those people.
And that's where there's a phenomenon. It's, I think, a 10-year-old one, death over dinner. So people can make choices about your end of life. You have only one go. And so that's where I would put my marbles. That game is building all of that, building those final connections, those kinds of things, instead of like creating a data set so that I can be projected artificially after the fact.
Yeah, and how is that artifact going to look in the future when you're dead? Is your family going to look at this? Are they going to be confused? Or are they going to look at it and say, well, there's Louise wishing she were living now? I don't know if it's confusing, but it doesn't seem healthy at all to me. Another AI portrait shows Katie Annell with her partner on their wedding day, which won't happen next year. And another shows Oge Anwa Chu at her son's graduation day in 2025, where she couldn't be prouder, standing by all her brilliant children. Now, I guess I get that, but she could stand by all her brilliant children right now. The more I read this, the more I feel like Edelson, the photographer, is an opportunist. And she's almost preying on these people to get noticed in the context of AI generation, so she'll generate more publicity for herself. That's just me, though. What do I know?
So that's the whole point, that this enterprise of extending these people past their death is preying on a vulnerable group of people. They're in grief, they're vulnerable financially, they're vulnerable emotionally.
In a similar story about artificial intelligence-generated post-death time travel from undark.org, do grief bots help mourners deal with loss? Various commercial products known as grief bots create a simulation of a lost loved one built on artificial intelligence that makes use of large language models. The bots imitate the particular way the deceased person talked by using their emails, text messages, voice recordings, and more. The technology is supposed to help the bereaved deal with grief by letting them chat with the bot as if they were talking to the person. But we're missing evidence that this technology actually helps the bereaved cope with loss. What's your take on that? Does that seem a little bit more honest than the photos?
No, it's not, because people are being sold this bill of goods that you are going to be able to feed in this long language model, giving the consumer of this enterprise, this grief bot, it's giving them the impression that because it starts with the dear departed's language, utterances, mannerisms, tones, and all that, that it must continue that authenticity. And it's a remarkable marketing problem for me. Now, this Justin guy from you only virtually, he is so swept up in his product, he's using his personal surviving story as a way of promoting how good his product is. And it's a pretty dishonest thing. And the more we know about synthetic data that's being used for artificial intelligence systems, the more I'm very unnerved about how one gets further and further removed from authentic person. I want my memories not to be marred by something projected later. I want to go back to what it was that I'm bonded with my loved ones that I've survived. I'm thinking mainly of family members that I've survived. I don't want anything to interfere with that memory of them. It's precious.
Yeah, and it seems like at least the people who are writing this article seem to have doubts about what's being created here. Whereas the article about the photographer was all in on dark.org. This one is at least bringing up doubts about the practice of generating dead people.
I listened to a podcast in Hidden Brain with the You Only Virtually entrepreneur, and there is a tremendous amount of skepticism by the time the producer wraps that podcast.
People don't know how to deal with death. This doesn't seem like a very healthy way to go about it, because death is an end. It's not an excuse to create another thing in hopes that it duplicates what has just died. It's time to move on, I guess I'd say.
And in the podcast with You Only Virtually, he actually says near the end of that interview that he doesn't think grief is at all helpful. His enterprise is really interfering with his sort of moral kind of project there.
What does he think's a good thing then, if you're not grieving?
His bond with his mother that he survives. It's displacing a good many living relationships. It's pretty revealing by the time one looks at as a case study of an entrepreneur developing a griefbot product. And I'm thinking, Nathan, you may remember Jessica Mitford, the muckraker of the funerary industry. She used to go after what the funeral sector used to do, preying on vulnerable, bereaved parties and the things they sold. They sold the highest end casket, the things that the dear departed would wear inside the casket, and on, just really running the tab. And Jessica Mitford from England, but was very involved in the opening up of options that one has for what to do with a body now dying, now dead. This is sort of like a Jessica Mitford sort of second round of muckraking, preying on vulnerable people.
It's revealing about the human predicament that when we get a technology that enables us to do a lot of good things in the present, like AI, somebody is going to use it to try and
make a buck,
make it appear. Yeah, make a buck by one of the oldest
grift
scams in the book. Mm-hmm. Yeah, grifts in the book. You're going to live longer if you take my medicine.
My snake oil.
You're going to be able to talk to your friends because we've recorded everything and it sounds like them, kind of. Which brings us to the article in The Guardian with Laurie Anderson. Oh, Superman Laurie Anderson, mm-hmm. American musician who was married to Lou Reed of the Velvet Underground.
And oh, yeah.
Reed died in 2013. Meanwhile, Anderson, last time she was in Australia in 2020, she worked with the University of Adelaide's Australian Institute for Machine Learning. Apparently, they put a lot of information about Reed in this AI model, his writing, his songs, and interviews. And a decade after his death, the resulting algorithm lets Laurie Anderson type in prompts before an AI Reed begins riffing written responses back to her in prose and verse. And Anderson's all sold on this, although I think she has a decent enough attitude about it. I'm totally 100% sadly addicted to this. She laughs, says the article. I still am after all this time. I kind of literally can't stop doing it, and my friends just can't stand it. Which I would understand. What I get out of that is I kind of wish Laurie would live her life. I thought she was a very future-looking person, and maybe we all get that way, but she seems to be looking at her past now and somehow trying to recreate something that was there rather than looking to her friends now. I think that's why her friends are upset. They wish they had her attention and not this bot.
That's what's happening in this enterprise. She's at the consumer end of this enterprise, but it's definitely eroding a survivor's relationships with the living. She may think that this is forward thinking, that she's working with the technology to do groundbreaking things. So that might be it. But also our public personas aren't necessarily the private ones, especially when we think about greed. There's a lot of those moving parts there, Nathan.
Yeah. But on the other hand, why would you want to talk to a family member? You've talked to them enough. They've had their time. You know, you've got your life to live. You should be talking to whoever you like. If the bots are out there, why wouldn't I want to talk to Richard Pryor? I think I'd like to talk to Richard Pryor. Ida Lupino, Richard Feynman, Albert Einstein, Jane Austen. Is it a guilt thing that you would want to talk to the person that you lived with and had an opportunity to talk with for decades instead of talking to Hedy Lamarr, Kurt Vonnegut, Norman Mailer, Frederick Douglass, Gore Vidal, Frida Kahlo, Lucille Ball, Amelia Earhart? If you'd like your own grief bot, may I recommend a donation to KUCI instead? Just go to kuci.org. Your generous donation is how we stay on air. Commercial-free, free-form, free speech radio, KUCI 88.9 FM, Irvine, California. Well, that's enough of that. How about we dial up my good friend Mike Kaspar of KUCI's award-winning program, Film School Radio. I hear he used to be a projectionist at the Balboa Theater back in the days of Deep Throat. Nixon, not Lovelace. So I was reading in, what was it, the Orange County Register, 2015 article that said the four brick walls are all that are left standing of the theater, once a hangout for Hollywood stars and a place to drink liquor during Prohibition. You know anything about that?
I do know a little bit about, I believe you're speaking about the Balboa Cinema on Balboa Boulevard.
Now, it says the roof leaks and it has a sand floor.
Now, that is new to me. So that I don't know anything about that.
Yeah. The interior is gutted more than a decade ago. The chairs were ripped out and sold. And the stage and the balcony are removed. And the city of Newport Beach has been discussing turning it into the Balboa Village Fine Arts Center, which would cost about $6 million. We've got an old theater down there that's falling apart, and you're part of its history.
I am. I came into the picture for the Balboa Cinema right around the end of 1976, right around December of 1976, Ron Huff and John Newcomb began renting the old Pussycat Theater from the Pussycat Company. And that's how it became the Balboa Cinema. There's a period of time that is discussed, I believe, in the article you're referring to, that Landmark took over after the Pussycat Theater essentially abandoned that building. That's not true. This is the period of time between when Landmark took over that I was there. What's not true is that Landmark took it over from the Pussycat Theater.
There's so much misinformation about this theater and so much that's left out of it, too. The Balboa Theater was called the Ritz originally in 1928. And honestly, it's kind of a modest theater.
It was in competition with the Lido for opening up at about the same time. And it beat the Lido by about 3 months as far as opening. So it was kind of a Chrysler Building, Empire State Building thing going on there. Now, you mentioned the Pussycat Theaters. I'm just curious. So the documents are doing business as Pussycat Theaters, or was it Pussycat Incorporated?
That I don't know.
But that seems to be, when you're reading the history of what's now called the Balboa Theater, or was called the Balboa Theater for most of its life, you hear about the Pussycat Theater. It was a porn house.
Right.
What's kind of curious to me, though, is that I believe before it became the Pussycat Theater, and I'm pretty sure about this, in 1969, Newport Beach police seized a reel of the controversial Swedish erotic film I Am Curious Yellow from the Balboa Theater just before a second showtime.
That was new to me. I did see that in the article. By the way, just by virtue of, I think this is another kind of confusing part of the story of the Balboa Theater. We referred to it when I was there as Balboa Cinema. On the poster that I have of one of our programs, one of our six-week programs, it says at the top, Balboa Cinema. Now, I think when Landmark came in, and maybe this is where we are today, I believe they were calling it the Balboa Theater. So that would make some sense.
I think it's curious, though, just going back to I Am Curious Yellow. It was a Swedish film, and even calling something a Swedish film back there in 1969 made you think it was something risque.
Yes.
This is before the Pussycat moved in. I would assume the notoriety of this event brought on the Pussycat.
Yeah.
And that's why they took over.
I would think so, yeah. Yeah. I think they were doing pretty well during that period of time. There were a lot of Pussycat theaters around Southern California. And I think they probably saw this as kind of a poking the eye of the uptight Republicans in Orange County, and probably thought there was an audience for this kind of repressed sexuality that I'm sure that they figured they could tap into.
In 1975, a trial to determine whether the Pussycat Balboa Theater violated local norms by exhibiting Deep Throat and The Devil and Miss Jones began. They charged the chain's owners and managers with 22 counts of showing obscene films. And so the Pussycat left and the Balboa came in.
It was Ron Huff and John Newcomb were the people who came in.
Ron and John.
Yeah. Now, Ron was Paul Williams, a singer, also part of a comedic duo during that period of time, very well known for many years as a songwriter, singer. And Ron was his manager. My understanding was he had been his manager from the beginning of his career. Two very colorful guys, both Ron and John. Ron was the good cop and John was the bad cop in their little relationship.
Did you have any run-ins with him?
Not at all, but John was very stern. He was Ron was more the artist of the theater. He's the one who really came up with some very creative double bills. And so did John. They were both film fanatics, yeah. Truly. In fact, they were a good yin and yang. But John definitely was the one who cracked the whip. They worked well together, and you know, my hat's off to them for what they were able to do.
The Balboa is known for being a Pussycat Theater, but it's also known for Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Right.
And I want to just get the experience of that out of the way, because you can applaud the Rocky Horror Picture Show, or you might choose not to. But that certainly wasn't the Balboa Cinemas or Balboa Theater's greatest contribution to the area. By that time, how would you describe it?
Keep in mind that when the Balboa Cinema came into existence in late 1976, there weren't VHS. There was no other outlet to see movies other than your million-dollar movie or your on television, which were cut up with commercials. This was really a new idea, although it'd been in LA and I'm sure New York for a long time, the idea of what they call a repertory house, a theater that would show films from around the world going back in the 20s and 30s. So this was kind of new, certainly for Orange County. So that was the thing that made us unique. And one of the reasons why it was so successful for so long was there was no VHS. There was no, obviously, streaming or anything like that. So we had an audience. It took a little while to build the audience, but once we did, we were selling out a lot of shows. A lot of shows were selling out. If you want to talk about Rocky Horror Picture Show, we showed it as part of a double bill in the middle of our schedule one time, and it was very popular. It had apparently already taken on the cachet of being this cult film and did very well when we screened it. That's when we started screening it as a Friday night midnight movie. And it became the film that killed the Balboa in many ways, because VHS started to come in around 1979, 1980. It became more popular. So
for those of you at home wondering what VHS is, just a video.
Cassette, a video cassette,
basically. For those
cassette,
of you at home wondering what a video cassette is, it was what we used before DVDs to watch movies.
Yeah. As that became more and more popular, you had access to the movies that we were screening, some of them, not all of them. And
for those of you wondering what DVDs are, that's what we used before streaming.
So over a period of time, as the attendance dropped off for our more adventurous part of the schedule, people started gravitating to the midnight showings, which went from just Friday to Friday and Saturday. And it became the only thing that kept the theater alive during the landmark years.
And the Balboa Theater closed in 1991.
My feelings about Rocky Horror as a cinematic experience, once or twice, it was fun. But it wore out its welcome as far as I was concerned. I get why people like it, and I get why it was a cult classic for its time.
Well, if you had to experience that every night or every weekend, people throwing food at the screen of the theater, and did they trash the place?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, at first, people would dress as the characters and come up, and there'd be, before the screening began, people would go around and there'd be a lot of conversation and exuberance over what people were wearing and all of that. It became a scene. It became, you know, an event. It wasn't just watching the movie. And there were a lot of people who got into it. And it was great. It was wonderful. You know, they were mimicking what was going on in the film. That became a thing, and singing along and yelling at the screen, which was fine. All that's fine. But after a while, they started trashing the place. I mean, literally, the seats became where they're ripping seats. I'm not blaming everyone who ever went to see Rocky Horror for what happened to the Balboa Cinema, but the people who were going in there did not respect the theater.
You're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM, Irvine, California. Visit us on the web at kuci.org, on Facebook at facebook.com/KUCI88.9, on our Tumblr blog at kuciradio.tumblr.com, and on Twitter and Instagram at KUCIFM. And now, back to Weekly Signals. All that aside, the Balboa Theater did more to educate people in Orange County during the period that you were there about cinema than I think any other theater in the county, and certainly would hold its own against anyone in the country, really, because of the wonderful taste of Ron Huff, who brought these films into Orange County, and you got a tremendous education by going there.
Yeah.
If nothing else, a cultural education, because some of the films were very old, and you got to see things that you would never be exposed to in the setting that they were originally presented.
Couldn't have said it better. I always liked movies, and one of the reasons why I was so interested in working there was because I did have a real love of films. One of the things about Ron and John and the other people who were brought in to work there, and by the way, this is one of my favorite parts of having gotten to work there, was the interview for my job. I remember sitting across the table from John, and he said, "What are your 5 favorite films?"
Ah. Do you remember them?
Yeah, I do remember. I actually do remember exactly what I said. And keep in mind, this is 1976. Yeah, so there's a lot of movies that I would add to that list now, but nonetheless, they were Duck Soup.
Yeah.
Doctor Strangelove.
Yeah.
Women in Love.
Ooh.
Persona.
Oh.
Oh, and Citizen Kane.
It almost sounds like you read a book of the greatest films of all time in preparation for your job interview.
I had no idea what the job interview was going to be. I literally had no idea. I just knew I wanted to work there. And I happened to live about 3 blocks away from the theater. So it was all divine providence as far as I'm concerned, at getting there, being in the right place at the right time. I was at that period in my life where I felt like I knew a lot about movies already. I wouldn't say I was a snob, but I knew what were highly regarded films. But I can tell you, Duck Soup. Most of those are still on my top 10 list. Dr. Strangelove, Duck Soup, and Citizen Kane are still, they still are right there. And I hadn't seen much of Bergman, but I had a teacher at Orange Coast College who loved Bergman. And as part of our class, he would show Bergman films like every other week. So I was, I felt a little snobby, you know, a little effete, oh, because I knew of Persona, which I still like a lot. So that was the job interview. And everyone got hired the same way. Everyone who was there, the same thing.
I would imagine you screened all these movies, too, as a projectionist there for the Balboa.
I believe I did. Yeah, that's a good question. I believe that I did. And that's another thing about the theater and the charm of the theater. The projectors that I was trained to be a projectionist, which I would have never imagined in what world that would have happened, because everyone else would have been union. I would have never gotten a job in LA because they're all union jobs. We obviously weren't. So I got trained on 1930-era projectors. That was quite a trip because when we would get a new double bill in, we had trailers for what was coming up. And we actually had to edit the trailer into the first reel of the first film we were going to be showing. So I got trained in using that old razor blade and the way of editing actual film in order to learn how. Yeah, I had to learn how to do that.
It's almost two turntables and a microphone.
Yeah, yeah.
If you know what I mean.
Yeah.
I'd assume that it took a degree of skill to get things moving.
Yeah, and I will tell you that I still have a couple of frames because inevitably you would actually end up cutting a frame out of one film or another. You had to get them to sync together. And I have a little 35mm film selves from some of the films. I kept a little memorabilia from my time there. But the point is I got to train on these ancient projectors, learned more about the technology of screening a film than I ever would have imagined. And it was an amazing experience on so many levels. Colossal mistakes and some wonderful presentations. We showed Gone with the Wind with the intermission. We could only screen it with a 16mm film. That's all we had, the film stock. So we had to mount a 16mm projector on the front of our 35mm projector, which was quite a trip. Just so many little, you know, just things about being there that you had to figure things out. Although I'd have no idea how many toxic chemicals I inhaled over the time I was up there.
Well, with the heat of that projection, was that something you'd notice getting up in the projection room?
Yeah. First of all, it'd be warmer up there anyway. And then in the summer, it would really get very, very hot up there. But one of the things that the projector that we used, these 1930s era projectors, or that you had, they looked like pencils, but they were actually made out of carbon. And they were two of them, and you would put one at the very back of the projector and then one in the middle of the projector. And when you push them together with the right kind of setup, they would actually spark a flame a flame would come off of them. And so that's how the light was projected off this convex mirror at the back of the projector. They would shoot the light through the lens. So that's how you got the light to project onto the screen. And you had to check them because over the course of the film, they would wear down. So you had to make sure the carbon that you were using, you had enough to get through a whole film.
Really? So you had to change these carbon pencils every how long? How many miles?
How many miles? Well, the other part of being a projector was these reels were about 20 minutes long.
Yeah.
That was the most you could put on a reel. It's 35mm film, about 20 minutes. So if a normal film, you know, an hour and a half to 2 hours, so that's we're looking at five or six changeovers over the course of a film.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd have to swap out those pencils probably every three rounds, every three times we use that projector. So it wasn't like all the time, but there was God knows what kind of chemical reaction was coming off of those things because you could smell it. That's for sure. But it was, again, you know, that was part of the fun of it was just sort of making sure that everything was okay. And then also, of course, you had to make sure that the changeover from one reel to the next went smoothly. And
yeah, how did that work? I mean, you had just one projector?
We had two projectors.
And is that how you made the change?
Yes. So we had two projectors. And so let's see, we open on... I'll call it projector one.
Okay.
And so right about 2 minutes before the end of that reel, the centrifugal force of the spinning reel would pop these two little ball bearings out of the reel. So you would hear this pinging sound. So you knew you had 2 minutes. Well, in the meantime, you would have loaded up projector two with the reel that you're going to switch over to. You'd go over to the second projector. And then this is, if you're old enough to remember watching TV, old TV and movies on old TV, that you would see these two dots or these black dots would occasionally appear on screen for the projectionist. That meant that you had to fire up the second projector to get it up to speed. And then you'd see another set of dots come up. And that was telling you that the reel was ending. So you had to see the first set of dots for sure. If you didn't, you were screwed. But once you saw them, you fired up the projector and it would get that reel up to speed. And then as soon as you saw the second set, you had like an extra, maybe a second and a half to 2 seconds before that reel would literally physically run out. So you hit these two buttons that opened up the aperture and the other one would turn on the sound. And that's how you got your changeover from one projector to the other.
Were you ever booed?
Oh, yes. I was booed. I screwed some things up big time. We were showing The Song Remains the Same, the Led Zeppelin film, concert film. And it was also only a 16-millimeter film. That's the only one we could get. And that completely went sideways about a half an hour into the screen. Completely. Everything went wrong. The projector screwed up, everything. And yeah, there was a lot of booing and a lot of pointing at me up in the projector booth and a lot of very upset people. That one was a disaster. I don't think we got through that screening, to be honest with you. And a lot of pissed off, drunken people were in the theater that day. But
drunken?
Oh, yeah. This was one of the midnight screenings we did for The Song Remains the Same. That was one. A very rare midnight screening, but yeah, that we did that. I don't want to just keep rambling on, but there was...
No, tell me about Singing in the Rain.
Yeah, okay. Well, this is, I think, my most creative screw-up. So we're showing a double bill of Singing in the Rain and The Wizard of Oz. And if you're a film buff, you know that the first part of Singing in the Rain has to do with Gene Kelly, and he's running around, he's being chased by his fans, and it... One point in the film, he's trying to get away, and he escapes by jumping into the car being driven by Debbie Reynolds. And she happens to be a theater performer, and she recognizes him from his film work. And they get into this spirited discussion about theater being better than film, and it goes back and forth and back and forth. Well, I had accidentally put the second reel of Wizard of Oz on the second projector. And what happens in the very beginning of the second reel, for you film buffs, it's 20 minutes into it, that Dorothy is opening the door from her farmhouse, from the farm, into the yellow brick road. So this discussion between Debbie Reynolds and Gene Kelly's going on about how lack of creativity in film, and then all of a sudden you see this door open, and it's into the Land of Oz, which could not be more colorful and more vibrant of a film you'd ever seen in your life. So people, I did this, and so people, I could hear people laughing out in the audience. So I sheepishly, of course, fixed the problem. But yeah, that's a story I'm going to be telling probably till the day I die.
Well, really what you were doing is you were making a comment on the value of cinema and how it can also move you and be just as creative as anything in the theater. Wasn't that what you were doing?
Yes, that's exactly right. That's how it turned out. There's just so many stories. And I reached, before we had this conversation, I reached out to somebody I used to work with, and they just reminded me of all of the different characters that came through there who we worked with, and not the least of which, and I didn't realize it at the time, but John Lovitz was dating one of the women that worked at the theater.
Huh.
My friend Brian is telling me that, yeah, he was around the theater a lot.
Any old timers other than John Lovitz?
Well, one night I was at the ticket counter and I'm selling tickets to everybody who's coming through the door. And I look up and I see this guy. I know him right away. I can recognize him. I hear somebody say, Joey Bishop. And so Joey Bishop is standing in front of me while I'm handing a ticket to him. And because I did find out that he had a house down on the peninsula. So
there were probably a lot of Hollywood folk who had houses down on the peninsula who would visit the Balboa, I would assume. And Joey Bishop, by the way, is pre-VHS. And he was one of the Rat Pack.
Yes. Well, going back to the history, and you had mentioned the Lido as kind of being the flagship, and it was for, I'm sure, for that Betty Davis, who had a house in Laguna Beach, used to, on her way back from L.A., would stop off at both the Balboa Cinema and the Lido to sit in the back of the theater and watch people watch her films to see what kind of reaction they were.
Well, good for Betty.
Yeah, good for Betty. Yeah.
I'd like to say that I saw her at the Balboa, but again, back to the film series that ran there for over, what, about 3 or 4 years? Is that what?
Well, when Landmark came in, it changed the culture of it a little bit. A solid 2.5 years, I think you can ascribe to this Balboa Cinema, yeah.
Well, the Balboa passed flyers around town
yeah.
that amounted to a calendar of what was playing during the month. And the flyers were an event. I would mark the dates of all the films I wanted to see, and there were a lot of them.
Yeah.
This is to, I think, Ron Huff's credit. There were just amazing double bills. There were themes running through what he was showing. It wasn't just hodgepodge. There yeah. was. That's why I said earlier on that it was an education going to these films. You would have a whole maybe week of film noir. And they seem to be matched up, would play off of each other.
Well, what I think what you're describing, Nathan, is in the way that they constructed the schedule, there would be like Monday night on that schedule would be for nothing but foreign films. And Tuesday night might be nothing but Bogart films. That's how they would do it. It changed with every schedule. So you had a huge variety of films.
The selection that you gave when you applied for the job, Duck Soup, Dr. Strangelove, Women in Love, Persona, and Citizen Kane, it wouldn't be that much of a stretch to say those films might have all played during the same month down there.
Yeah.
And to see them on a big screen, to have that opportunity to see them in a theater with other people on a big screen, I don't really know why you'd want Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Yeah.
To see Duck Soup on a big screen in glorious black and white with a group of people who are roaring along with you with the Marx Brothers was a singular experience that you take with you forever.
Yeah, absolutely. And I happened to, one of the things that I took away from the Balboa was one of these 6-week or 7-week schedules that we had posted in front of the theater. And I'm looking, just as I said, one night was Brando. Another night was what you would call cult films. We had Rocky Horror. We had Carrie, Wizards, Fantastic Planet. And then on Friday and Saturday, we had a double bill that was consistent, usually the same double bill for 2 nights. And then you get into the classics, and you're talking about Kate Hepburn and Spencer Tracy. I mean, we can curate our own, you know, what we want to watch now, and that's great. But there's something about going to see a film in a theater that is unlike any other experience. And also to be able to know, as you said, Ron and John knew what they were doing.
Yeah.
At that time, it wasn't like today where you knew all of the different places you could pull a film in from a distributor. There's dozens and dozens of distributors now. Back then, the idea of what they were doing while they were doing it in Los Angeles, but it was still a pretty small number of theaters were doing this. I just remember Ron and John, especially Ron, ripping their hair out about whether or not a film was going to make it to the theater for the screening.
Oh, yeah.
Because it was, because you just didn't, it wasn't that reliable, the films and the way that they got the films into the theater.
Well, those days are over. And from what I can tell, what's left of the Balboa Theater will probably be demolished soon. It might be a performing arts venue, but
a lot of people have talked about reviving it. The problem is because, as you mentioned at the beginning, all of the seats are gone. There's probably some structural issues. Plus, since it closed, the state of California has passed much more stringent
yeah.
earthquake requirements for older buildings. And the money involved in making it whole yeah. again is several million dollars.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't pencil out as something of a for-profit. Maybe the city would take it on as sort of a performing arts center of some kind. But also the other thing was that foundation that you're referring to, I don't know if it's the same one, but there was a foundation for the Balboa Cinema or Theater. And apparently they got into some kind of weirdness over who was taking money from where and doing what with it. So that kind of killed it.
Yeah, I'll say. Well, you know, as far as saving the Balboa Theater or whatever you'd want to call it or bringing it back, I say, let it die.
Yeah.
We had a wonderful time there, and it taught us a lot of great stuff and entertained us, and really a landmark in my mind for my misspent youth. It brought me out of that, and it made me a better person for having seen a lot of those films. There's other things for people to experience these days that are just as great, and I feel fortunate to have encountered that theater. And I say we got to learn how to die and let go of things, and that's just one more thing, which is fine. It's wonderful to have experienced it.
One other thing that I find fascinating about our conversation was that I must have met you.
You might have taken my ticket.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So we're talking now, you know, 40-some years ago that we met somewhere in the cosmos of life. And that I just think is such a cool thing, too.
Yeah,
so,
film buffs.
Film buffs. All right, well, thank you, Nathan.
All right, Mike. Okay. So we've heard from Claudia Shambaugh and Mike Casper today, Mahler. Anything else? How about one for you? Did you ever wish that a certain someone was dead? Real funny, Mahler. But seriously, have you ever thought that the world would be a better place without someone? There'd be no repercussions, no death penalty, no shaming, no stockade, no punishment. I wouldn't take away your chicken snacks. In fact, no one needs to know about your wish, except for me, of course. And I promise I won't squeal. After all, I'd be complicit in your wish. The method of extermination would be your choice. You could wish for poison, drowning, meat whacker, a pig pen for a week with piggies to pick your certain someone clean. Are you in? Maybe? Okay. Did I mention that the world would be a better place without this certain someone? I mean, they're despicable. A lump of foul deformity. And just to sweeten the pot, to call this certain someone a hypocrite would be an understatement. They're a pathological liar. Their deceit oozes out of their mouth like drool from a baby. In fact, they are a baby. A spoiled brat. But maybe that's too much information. Remember, this is just a wish, an invented example. What's that? There's a difference between wishing someone were dead and actually doing it? Of course, but I'm not asking you to do it. I'm asking you to wish for it. I'm asking you to ask God or the fates or the precision of circumstance to make it so. So in a way, it is an action, I guess. But consider this. This certain someone is dangerous. And they're dangerous because they're consequential. They're able to control millions of people, and their love for their control. People will love them because this certain someone is like their daddy, and that love threatens us all. Let me ask you again. Would you wish that a certain someone were dead if you knew the world would be a better place for it? No? You're nothing but a privileged pacifist, afraid of a little homicidal wish. I know you want to. Don't other dogs wish some people were dead? Yeah, I thought so. Don't you fantasize about throwing the dog catcher out the window? How about silencing that screaming baby? I often wish people were dead, just a little bit, especially when they're holding up the line at Trader Joe's. Did you know that murder fantasies are normal? Or homicidal ideation, as it's sometimes referred to by researchers? That was established back in 1993. They ran some tests and the majority of participants said yes. 73% of men and 63% of women said, yeah, we think it about killing people. This surprised the researchers, so they did another test to confirm they hadn't just tested an especially murderous lot. And the same thing was found. 79% of men and 58% of women this time claimed they had murder fantasies. Men were more likely to imagine killing strangers and co-workers, while women preferred family members, probably their husbands. Which reminds me, when it comes to asking if you'd wish that a certain someone in the past were dead, no one's name comes to mind more than Adolf Hitler. So even if he were a cute little giggling infant playing with his toes, I'm thinking if you were sent back to, say, April 20th, 1899, which is when Hitler was born, you'd kiss the newborn Hitler's face, hoping that this would make him not such a little Nazi. Yeah. My guess is that baby Hitler, all grown up, would turn around and throw you in the gas chamber. Violence begets violence, but as far as I can tell, so does extreme pacifism. So, did you ever wish a certain someone were dead? The opinions and views expressed in this program are not necessarily those of KUCI, the UC Board of Regents, Dickie Betts, or Carl Erskine. This is KUCI 88.9 FM Irvine, California, on the web at kuci.org. I'm Nathan Callahan, and this is Weekly Signals.